Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of Conspiracy You Could Believe In. This one is a supplement to the episode from 2 weeks ago, The Plot to Kill Patrice Lumumba. So if you haven't listened to that one, I would recommend listening to that first because it's going to provide a lot of context for what I'm going to be talking about. Just a reminder that these bonus episodes are not dealing with particular conspiracies. They're not scripted. This is just extra information that you might find interesting if you found the other episode interesting. So I'm going to try to do more of these because, honestly, they're a little easier than writing out other episodes, which I've found take me quite a bit of time. I'm still going to continue to do them, but I do like having an outlet for the information that had to be left on the cutting room floor. So this episode is based on what I read in King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild, which was a groundbreaking book about the Belgian Congo and the atrocities committed there. Just a note up top, going to be talking about atrocities in this episode. So if you don't want to hear about racial violence, about slavery, sexual violence, mass murder, don't listen to this because that's what that book is about. It was a really earth-shattering book for much of the Western world, especially in Belgium, when it was published. It still generates a lot of controversy because a lot of people don't want to admit the extent of the atrocities committed under Leopold II in the Belgian Congo. The other book that I used for the previous episode was The Assassination of Lumumba by Ludo de Witte, a Belgian investigative reporter and sociologist who, after extensive study of interviews of people involved, of going over the records from the Belgian government and the CIA at the time, came to the conclusion that the Belgian government directly ordered the murder of Patrice Lumumba in 1960. So that's what the episode from 2 weeks ago was about. When de Witte published this, it also created a lot of controversy, especially in Belgium. Belgium to this day has not admitted direct responsibility for the murder. They've admitted indirect responsibility for the murder of Patrice Lumumba. But his book became very popular, especially among admirers of Patrice Lumumba. It was used as the source for a biopic called Lumumba by Raoul Peck, which I recommend. It's a great movie. And that's really when the popular image of Lumumba outside of the African diaspora got to be more and more positive, which I'll talk about later on in this show. But first, what is the Congo? What are we talking about when we talk about the Congo River Basin or the Democratic Republic of the Congo? If you want to go back to the beginnings of this part of the world's relationship with Europe, you got to go back to the 1480s when the Portuguese first made contact with the Kingdom of the Congo. Now, it gets a little confusing because Congo is the name of two modern-day countries, the Republic of the Congo, which was colonized by the French, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is the Congo we're talking about, which was colonized by Belgium, and it's also the name of a river and the name of an ethnic group, the Congo people. So the Congo people live near the mouth of the Congo. If you look at a map of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, you notice it has this little, it's really big in the middle. It has this little panhandle that goes out towards the ocean that follows the Congo River. So the Congo people live around that area and parts of Angola. And that's where the Kingdom of the Congo was in the 1480s when the Portuguese made contact. And it was a kingdom. They had a system of government. They had a sophisticated system of taxation. They had ironworking. They had cities. They had a king. The Portuguese were able to establish diplomatic relations with them. They sent missionaries. They eventually adopted Catholicism. And they traded with Portugal. Ivory, gold, stuff like that, but also human slaves. Now, they did have slavery in the Kingdom of the Congo. It was different from chattel slavery as it would be practiced in the New World. It was not practiced at that scale. people could age out of slavery. They were not necessarily born into slavery if they were born to slaves. But kings of Congo did begin to trade with the Portuguese in human trafficking. Now, eventually, this relationship became fraught. There's a guy, King Afonso the First of Congo, who was seen as a great reformer among his people. He adopted a lot of Western technology. He sent his sons to go study in Europe. He was very, very Catholic. But one of the things that he started to bring up and protest to the Portuguese was that they were just taking too many people. The Portuguese were eventually taking about 15,000 people every year from the Kingdom of the Congo, and it was just too much. They were bringing them largely to Brazil, and the reason why they're bringing so many people to Brazil is they are growing sugar there in plantations, and it was a dangerous job. People died from injury, from overwork, from disease. The attrition was high. Many, many thousands of people died or were killed. So they were just going to modern-day Congo, modern-day Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, that area, and siphoning off thousands of people every year. Now, if you yourself are the descendant of slaves in the Western Hemisphere, it is very likely that you are descended from some of these people in the Congo region, especially if you are from Brazil or if you are from coastal Georgia, South Carolina, if your ancestors came from that area. In fact, linguists have even studied the Gullah people in coastal Georgia and South Carolina, and they have determined that some of the features of their language are related to the Congo language in Africa. So I found that to be pretty interesting. But this is where the plunder started, with the Portuguese and the Congo Kingdom. King Afonso protested to stop it, but it didn't. The good news, though, is that the Portuguese were never able to venture very far upriver. Because the Congo River, just to get a little bit into geography here, the Congo River is a huge river system, but it has a lot of waterfalls. And about 90 miles inland, there is the first major waterfall. Ships are not able to get past it. Portuguese tried to go around it over land, and it never worked. People died of malaria, or they got lost in the jungle or the mountains. So Europeans were not able to explore the interior of the Congo until the 1870s. This was a largely unknown part of the world to them. But by the 1870s, all of the great nations of Europe are starting the scramble for Africa. They are sending missionaries, they are sending armies, merchants, explorers, what have you, to eventually carve up the continent for their own imperial domains. And as we mentioned on the last episode, one of the people who was very interested in this was Leopold II of Belgium. He wanted that central Congo basin that remained unexplored, largely unvisited by Europeans at that time. He used a guy, Henry Morton Stanley, who was this very self-aggrandizing American journalist, who was actually born in Wales. He made a big name for himself by discovering David Livingstone, who was a British missionary who had been presumed dead somewhere in Central Africa. Well, Henry Morton Stanley found him, and he said the famous phrase, "Dr. Livingstone," I presume, or he claims that's what he said. And that became part of popular culture throughout the 20th century. It's something I remember seeing in cartoons and stuff as a kid, and I never really knew much else about it. Well, it turns out Henry Morton Stanley was also the personal agent of Leopold II, this guy who would eventually be responsible for some of the largest cases of mass murder in human history. Stanley was employed by Leopold to basically open up the Congo Basin for him, to establish these trading stations along the Congo River, because the thing about the Congo River is it has this series of waterfalls that go up to what's now called Kinshasa, and then there's about 1,000 miles of unimpeded river, And today it goes to a city called Kisangani. It was called Stanleyville. These were river stations that were set up by Stanley, and the river traffic was, you were able to get steamboats up and down the Congo River, and it's still to this day used as a major transportation route. What Stanley also did while he was there is he had kind of a private security force that plundered. They killed some people. They took ivory and rubber and other riches, and they also signed these phony contracts with local chiefs who maybe didn't know what they were signing, probably didn't even speak the same language, and thought they were signing something else. But what that eventually led up to is this patchwork of claims of land that Leopold now had in the Central Congo. It didn't really amount to much yet because it wasn't internationally recognized, but really a white guy was able to go into Central Africa and just say, hey, this other important white guy owns all this. That's basically what happened. Leopold then had a massive international PR campaign, probably one of the most successful PR campaigns in history. He hired Henry Sanford, who had been the American ambassador to Belgium, as a lobbyist. And Sanford also was the founder of the town in Sanford, Florida. He had like some kind of estate there. So Leopold kind of had this diplomatic toehold in the United States. And by convincing people that he was going to set up free trade, that he was going to establish schools and spread Christianity and all this other stuff, he was really pushing it as a project of civilization. And the Americans really liked that. So they recognized Leopold's claim to the Congo Basin based on all of this lobbying that he did through Henry Sanford. And Leopold owned, you know, quote, owned the Congo through what today we would probably call like a nonprofit or an NGO. He had a philanthropic organization that he controlled the Congo through as his own personal property. Then following in 1884, there's the Berlin Conference where all of these European powers are meeting and trying to cement who owns what in Africa, and King Leopold walks away from it getting international recognition among the nations of Europe that he personally owns the Congo Basin. And he does that in part through promising free trade. So this becomes known as the Free State of Congo. He builds his own private army, which I talked about in the last episode, the Force Publique. And this is really where the atrocities ramp up on a very big scale, is in the late 1880s and through the 1890s, it gets really bad. So I mentioned that waterfall that starts about 90-100 miles inland on the Congo River. They need to get to modern-day Kinshasa, where the waterfall stops, and then they have that 1,000-mile stretch of wide-open river. So they need to connect the coast with the river. They do that through a railroad. They use forced labor to build the railroad. Before the railroad, they were using human porters to carry luggage, to carry cargo, goods that they were bringing in and out of Africa. A lot of people died doing that. A lot of people also died building the railway. Eventually, it goes from Matadi on the coast, which was the main port of the Congo, it still is today, up to what was then called Leopoldville, which would become the capital of the Congo Free State and Belgian Congo. Now, all of this infrastructure that's being built, the railroads, the river ports, the civil service of the Congo Free State, the Force Publique, the army, everything about this government, if you want to call it that, is based on resource extraction. They are taking resources from the Congo Basin, and it is a very natural, resource-rich area, and they are taking it out of the country and bringing it to Belgium. And the resource that becomes very, very important in the 1890s is rubber. Keep in mind, this is the 1890s. Electricity is starting to be a thing in Europe and the United States. So rubber is going to be a very important resource for insulation of wiring and stuff like that. And it comes from trees at this time, natural latex rubber. In other parts of the world, Southeast Asia and Brazil, people are tapping rubber trees for the latex that will, the sap that will come out of the tree. In the Congo, it comes from vines. These huge woody vines that will grow in the middle of the jungle in the Congo Basin. There is a huge amount of them and a lot of wealth to be extracted for Leopold personally. And he uses forced labor, slavery, mass murder to get it out. The Force Publique, the Congo Free State's army, conscripts native Africans to go out into the jungle and collect quotas of rubber from the forest. And if they don't do it, they face imprisonment. The Force Publique could come to their village, take all of their women. Rape often happened when that occurred. Or they could just be killed. So they had to do it. And it's very dangerous work. They're sending pretty much the entire productive force of a village when, you know, instead of hunting or growing food, they're going out into the jungle. They're climbing these huge tall trees. A lot of people fall down, die, or get injured, and they have to cut the vines. Normally, if you want a sustainable harvest of natural latex rubber from vines, you would just make a little incision, let the rubber collect, and leave it and go to another vine. They have to get a quota, and they have to get it fast. So people are hacking the vines, letting all of the latex drip out. And the way they collect it, the only way they can do it, is by smearing the latex on their bodies, waiting for it to dry, and then ripping all of it off. It's extremely painful. It took off skin, hair. This was not a fun job to have, even if you survived. And a lot of people didn't. The quotas were almost impossible to meet, which meant people were executed by the Force Publique. Now, many of the soldiers of the Force Publique were black Africans themselves. Sometimes they were enslaved. But the leadership were all white, as a rule. And what the white leadership of the Force Publique was terrified of was, what if these guys use those guns on us? So they had very strict rules on using a very limited supply of ammunition. They didn't want to give them too much ammunition because then they could turn the guns on the white officers. So they instituted a policy, or many of the white officers did, of producing a trophy from the people who were executed for not meeting the rubber quota. And that was often a severed human hand. So in addition to a quota of rubber being extracted from the native people of the Congo Basin, there was now a quota and a market for human hands. I mean, this sounds like hell on earth. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, this was one of the worst places to be alive in human history. Villages would attack other villages to get hands so that they could basically save their own people. The Force Publique would indiscriminately kill. And because pretty much all of the people in this region were forced to gather rubber instead of, say, you know, grow food, there was famine and disease. So a lot of people died from that too. And this went on for 20, 25 years, all throughout the late 1880s, up until 1908. And there was still forced resource extraction after that too. But while all of this is going on, Leopold II still has this big PR pitch to the world that he is bringing civilization to Africa, you know, that he has all of these Catholic missions throughout the Belgian Congo where they were vectors of disease, by the way, you know, taking whole villages of little kids away from their parents and then putting them in crowded conditions where they would die of the flu. That was another atrocity that happened. But he's using all of these examples as how he's bringing industry to the Congo, or he's educating people, or this and that. And it sold itself as like a kinder, gentler version of imperialism. And like I said, people in America bought it. And there was one guy in particular, a guy named George Washington Williams. He's an interesting guy. He's from Ohio. He's a black Union veteran. He's now a diplomat, and he gets interested in what's going on in the Congo, but he really only knows what the stuff from the PR pitch is. He doesn't know what's happening, so he goes to visit it expecting to see, you know, this enlightened society, and what he finds horrifies him because he actually gets on a boat on the Congo River. He sees people, just masses of people without hands. You know, this becomes a very common sight to see in the Congo Free State. Are people missing their hands? Entire villages of people who were maimed by the force publique. So in 1890, he writes one of the first public condemnations that get out to the rest of the world about what's going on in the Congo. It's an open letter to Leopold II, and it's actually one of the first usages, if not the first usage, of the term crimes against humanity that we've ever seen. But that's what he accuses Leopold of, and he starts spreading the word to other people. Another person that in the 1890s begins to get wind of what's going on is this guy, Edmund Morel. Edmund Morel is, you know, he's a very liberal-minded, middle-class guy in Britain. He gets a job as a shipping agent for this company in Liverpool. They send him to Belgium in the port of Antwerp. I know I'm not saying that right. I'm sorry if you're from Belgium. And he notices these ships going to the Congo, and they're only carrying guns, ammunition, explosives, and chains. Very suspicious. And they're only coming back from the Congo to Belgium with rubber, ivory, gold, stuff like that. There's really not really things useful for a civilizing mission. So he gets suspicious and he starts to think something bad is happening in the Congo. No one really listens to him. But then other Europeans who go to the Congo expecting to see this, you know, grand civilizing mission actually see stuff with their own eyes. And one of them is Joseph Conrad, the author of Heart of Darkness, which is published in 1899. If you've read it, you know that it is about this twisted, deranged colonial project in the Belgian Congo. It becomes a best-selling book. People are starting to figure out what's going on, and the rubber trade from Congo begins to be known as red rubber. But probably the most extensive reporting on what was happening in the Congo came from a guy, Roger Casement. At the time, he was working as a diplomat for the United Kingdom, although he was Irish. He goes to the Congo. He travels up the Congo River. He interviews people about what's happening here, and he publishes a report about, like, look, these are the people I talked to. This is what they told me is happening. This is the extent of what's going on, and this is what the Belgian government and the King of Belgium is doing to cover all of this up. There is just an organized mass murder going on in the Belgian Congo just to plunder the whole region of its natural wealth. And he was right. That was what was going on. So Casement joins forces with Edmund Morel. This reform movement gets started to, at the very least, if they can't stop what's going on in Congo, at least get it under control of the government of Belgium so that Leopold can be stopped. Keep in mind, he's a constitutional monarch. He's not supposed to have this level of political power. So the Belgian government eventually does step in 1908, and they take the Congo Free State from him. It is now administered by the Belgian government themselves, although they have to take on this massive amount of debt that Leopold incurred as part of the deal of them taking the Congo from him. He makes a lot of money off of this. It was several billion dollars. And even though he dies the next year, I believe the Belgian royal family still has all of the money. Ironically, Leopold never actually set foot in the Congo. He never went there, even though he did set all of this stuff up to happen and did direct the system and the army that carried out these atrocities. So he is ultimately responsible. And he burned a lot of the records of what happened. So he knew what he was doing. He wasn't aloof to what was going on in the Congo just because he never physically went there. Another interesting thing about Roger Casement, he became an Irish nationalist, opposed to British rule of his own country, and would go on to die after helping out the Easter Rising in 1916 in Dublin. He was helping to get arms to them and would be executed by the British for that, and he's now known as something of like a national hero in Ireland. But back to the Belgian Congo, formerly the Congo Free State. The atrocities are supposed to be over, but slavery is still going on. Forced labor is still going on. There are cash crops grown in the Congo at this time. Cotton, coffee. There's a lot of money in coffee still to this day from the Congo. People are forced to work in these conditions, and they're forced to work in mines even more and more. People are taken from villages and brought to work in copper mines, in gold mines. There's a huge gold deposit there, and also uranium. I believe most of the world's uranium deposits are in the Congo Basin. So this is big money for Belgium, not for the native Congolese. They're not really getting any share of the wealth here that they're creating by being forced to labor in these conditions. There's also this apartheid-like society set up by white Belgians. Only white Belgians can live in the center of towns in the Congo. There is a racial caste structure. The overwhelming majority of people that live in the Belgian Congo, I don't even know if you can say they're treated like second-class citizens. They're not really treated like citizens at all. And by the 1950s, this is starting to change. There is a wave of anti-colonial movements happening across Africa. States in West Africa, like Ghana, are declaring independence, and they're getting independence from bigger countries like Britain, who can't hold on to their empire. What can Belgium do? You know, they're a pretty small country. So Belgium realizes they can't keep the Belgian Congo without a war that they would probably lose. So what they do is they try to negotiate the best possible deal that they can get with an independent Congo. You know, maybe they can still keep extracting all that wealth. Maybe they can still get all of the money out of the Congo while not being technically in charge of it. So they try to stall independence as much as they can, but there's only so much they can do. And by 1960, they have to hand over power officially on June 30th. And of course, the person they hand power over to is Patrice Lumumba. He had been elected prime minister earlier that year. His party got a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality, about like 25%. They're the largest party in the legislature of the new independent Congo. And they form alliances with other nationalist parties. And it is clear there is a growing anti-Belgian nationalist movement led by Lumumba. The Belgians don't like that. And if you listen to the last episode, you know what they did about it. You know, they ended up killing Lumumba. But what, you know, what about him? What brought him to the forefront of this movement? How did he get elected in the first place? Because he was a very young guy. He was like 34 years old. Lumumba was part of a very small black middle class in the Congo. He had been educated at Catholic mission schools, at some Protestant mission schools, and, you know, he was able to get a decent education there. And plus, you know, he was such a smart, charismatic guy. He was almost like a natural leader. He ends up going to Stanleyville, now Kisangani. He becomes a postal clerk and becomes a leader in the local public service workers union. And that's kind of how he gets his start in politics. But he gets his start in politics as something of a moderate in the 1950s. He wrote a book called Congo, My Country. I could not find it. Apparently, it's been out of print for decades. But from what I read of reviews, it is very early in his political development, and he was very moderate. It was all about how we can work with Europe as an independent Congo. It wasn't the nationalist rhetoric that he used when he actually became prime minister. So what changed? mean, the situation's changed. For one thing, he got sent to prison for protesting. And you can probably imagine Belgian Congo prison, not very good. He wasn't treated very well. And the other thing that, you know, probably didn't help was the Belgians stalling independence after it was very clear they were not going to hold on to it and they were very unpopular. So Lumumba gets a little more radical. He gets closer to Pan-Africanism. There's a guy, Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, the president of Ghana, who becomes a leader in a more militant vision of independence after the colonial powers leave, where it's not just that you have to have your own government, you have to have your own country. And what that means for Lumumba is they can't have a system where the Belgians are able to play off all of these various ethnic groups in the Congo against each other and hold on to all of the wealth that they've already extracted from the Congo and to hold on to the means of production of extracting that wealth in the Congo. In Lumumba's mind, and he was very clear about this, the gold, the copper, uranium, the mineral wealth, the oil, the agricultural wealth, that belonged to the people of the Congo. And he was also clear that he was willing to work with Europeans, with the United States, with anybody that was willing to negotiate fairly. But what they couldn't do and what he wouldn't tolerate were Belgian or French or American companies still owning and controlling most of the wealth of the Congo. He didn't want that. So that made him pretty dangerous for the U.S., for Belgium, for a lot of people in Europe. And because he died so young, it's really hard to tell where he would have wound up politically. But the other thing that he was clear about is he wasn't a communist and he wasn't really open to the idea of allying with the USSR. He sought out their military help when no one else would help put down these Belgian-led rebellions in his own country. But he ultimately did not want to be aligned in the Cold War. Now, the CIA didn't see it that way, and they, you know, of course, tried to assassinate him, as you heard in the previous episode. But he was really demonized in the Western press, and it wasn't until relatively recently that the view of Lumumba changed, especially among white people in Western countries. Because he was treated as kind of like a hardliner or an authoritarian, and if you really look at it, not really. He achieved power through democratic means. He tried to hold on to it when power was taken from him illegally by a ceremonial president who, it turns out, was being backed up by foreign countries. And even things that he did that may seem undemocratic to us, like he declared martial law at one point. He had the legal power to do that, and his country was facing a foreign invasion and two foreign-backed civil wars. So it's not like this guy was a military dictator, okay? He was elected. But here's just an example of the kind of demonization that Lumumba went through in the European press at the time. This was from 1960 in July when Lumumba went to visit the U.S. This is from La Libre Belgique. It's a big Belgian newspaper. Lumumba went to visit the United States, and this is what this newspaper says about him. At Blair House, that's the president's guest house in the United States, at Blair House, an old lady looks after the guests. She is white. Let us hope nothing happens to her. So that's the kind of stuff they're talking about Lumumba doing in Belgian newspapers at the time. Just openly racist. Just openly racist about this guy. Luckily, the view of Lumumba changed in a lot of Western countries, especially after the publication of King Leopold's Ghost and Ludo de Vita's The Assassination of Lumumba and Raoul Peck's movie Lumumba. I think people started to realize they were being told a narrative that came from the Cold War where people did everything in their power to demonize this man, to justify eventually having him murdered, which is what they did to him. And he gets replaced with General Mobutu, who, after 3 years of him putting down rebellions, Mobutu becomes the dictator of the Congo, which he renames Zaire. And he's actually a dictator, okay? He's not Lumumba. He did not achieve power through democratic means. He took it because he got bought off by the U.S. And I mean literally, they handed him suitcases full of cash throughout 1960 to help him pay off his army, which he used to take over the state. And he was in power until 1997 as one of the United States' closest allies in Africa throughout the Cold War because he was anti-communist. The U.S. just saw, well, he must be good. He's on our side. So we'll let him do whatever he wants. And what he did was he killed thousands of people. He ruled like a despot, and he walked away with billions of dollars of cash when he was finally forced out in 1997. And the Democratic Republic of the Congo is still dealing with the fallout from this to this day. They are still dealing with just massive civil conflict throughout their country, especially in the eastern part of the country, that's being driven by the vast mineral wealth. One of the big commodities now is coltan, which is a mineral that's used in cell phones. Again, one of the largest deposits of it on Earth, most of the Earth's coltan, is found in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So, you know, why is it that this country that has this vast wealth, you know, this is a rich country in terms of resources, why is it that this country doesn't have that wealth among its people? And a large part of that, I would say the biggest part of that, is because their history has been a history of plunder from other people coming to their country, taking the wealth, and taking it out of the Congo. Portugal stole their people. Leopold II stole their rubber. Union Minière, which was that big mining company, you know, that backed the secession of Katanga, if you listen to the previous episode, they stole their copper. And the Belgian Foreign Ministry, the CIA, and the UN a little bit, they teamed up to steal their first democratically elected leader who, if he were allowed to actually serve out his term, who knows where the Congo would have ended up today. I think that Lumumba probably would have nationalized mining industries. He seemed to be moving in that direction, and I think that would have been good for them. But it scared the hell out of these mining companies, and I think that's a big reason why he got killed. Now, knowing all of this, it does upset me if I see stuff in the news about, like, Democratic Republic of the Congo having a big debt or so many billions of dollars of debt to the IMF or World Bank or whatever. We don't need to be talking about them owing anybody money. The world owes them. Okay, Belgium still has not claimed direct responsibility for killing Lumumba, and they ordered his death. They still have not paid reparations to the country for what Leopold II did. And the royal family, at least some members of their royal family, still defend Leopold II. There are still statues of him up in Belgium. And one good thing that I remember seeing this year is during the protests after the murder of George Floyd, there were protests in Belgium because there is a large community of people in Belgium who are either from the Congo or of Congolese descent. They walk every day past statues of Leopold II, every day. And this summer, those statues finally started to get vandalized, started to get taken down, and local cities are starting to take them down. They're not all down yet, though, and there are members of the Belgian royal family trying to keep them up. And, oh man, it makes me mad. You know, I know that I've said that this whole podcast is supposed to be about non-crank conspiracy theories, but, you know, maybe Lyndon LaRouche is right about one thing. You know, maybe the royal families of Europe are reptiles or something. I mean, it's really just disgusting, that family trying to keep up statues of Leopold II. So we can't pretend like all this stuff is in the distant past, you know. And I'm not usually explicit about what my personal politics are on here, or at least I try not to be. You can probably guess I'm not conservative. I don't vote Republican, but in this country, Democrats are guilty of pretending like this stuff is in the past, too. You know, imperialism in the U.S. is bipartisan. There's a quote I came across from then-Secretary of State Clinton, and this is from 2010. This is from a forum about an African trade deal that was in the works at the time. And she said, quote, "For goodness sakes, this is the 21st century. We've got to get over what happened 50, 100, 200 years ago, and let's make money for everybody. That's the best way to try to create some new energy and some new growth in Africa." So, just a reminder, Mobutu, who was the ally of the United States, who came to power in part because the U.S. bribed him and developed his army for him, he died in 1997. That's not ancient history. Okay, the plunder of the Congo had long-lasting, debilitating effects for the people of the country. They still do not control their own wealth, and they are still owed billions of dollars by the countries responsible. You don't just get over that. And, you know, that's the liberal party of this country talking. That, it just infuriates me. So, I hope you read King Leopold's Ghost. It's a great book. It is very depressing, but very eye-opening about what went on in a part of the world I never really learned about. It's not something that was covered. I don't think I even knew Belgium had a colony in the Congo until I read it. And also, the assassination of Lumumba by Ludo de Vita. They're both really good insights into how our country and also countries in Europe can really screw things up for other people, especially in that part of Africa. And Raoul Peck's movie Lumumba is also really good. So that does it for this bonus episode. Sorry to be a downer, but you know, I felt like this is a really important and very interesting subject that isn't really covered a lot beyond just, you know, this disconnected tragedy going on at the other side of the world that we have no connection to or responsibility for in the West, and that's really not the case. So if you read these books, I think you'll be angry about it, but maybe better informed. And again, you know, my usual caveat here is I certainly have opinions about this stuff. I don't have a solution because I'm just a guy with a podcast. I do this for a hobby. Please go do your own research and take everything I say with a grain of salt. But next week, I found a pretty interesting topic, especially for listeners in Chicago. It's another Chicago conspiracy. This one is about the Summerdale scandal. It is a police scandal that happened in 1960. It is a crime story, and it's a huge one that I think is often forgotten about and not talked about enough. So I'm excited to bring that to you in November. Thanks for listening.